Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The latest Catawba College YouGov polls are out, asking North Carolinians questions ranging from their opinions on the governor's race to affordability to the state of our democracy, even feelings about the prospect of political violence. It's a snapshot of voter sentiment on our 250th birthday that confirms the deep division in the country, but also what could be a turning of the tide. And we'll take you through what this poll uncovered as we go through this hour. Dr. Michael Bitzer is a professor of history and politics and the director of the Center for North Carolina Politics and Public Service at Catawba College. They conducted this poll. He's also the author of Redistricting and Gerrymandering in North Carolina, Battle Lines in the Tar Heel State. Welcome back, sir. Good to see you again.
Good to be with you.
He's here along with two people who can share their perspective on both the left and the right. Paige Mastin is deputy opinion editor for the Charlotte Observer, and Andrew Dunn is a conservative political columnist whose opinions can often be found in the Observer. He's also the founder of Longleaf Politics, a Substack publication offering what it describes as a smart conservative approach to North Carolina politics. Welcome to the two of you. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. So, Michael, I'm going to start with you because you're the guy behind all of this. You released this poll in four separate parts, one on the political mood of our state, one on American identity, a third on how people, what people viewed as their priorities. And just moments ago, it's 9:08 and 11 seconds. At 9 o'clock, you released the fourth poll on democracy, elections, and violence. Why did you choose to release these results that way?
Well, the first one was really a kind of overview of not just Trump's approval and disapproval, but the horse races for U.S. Senate, for Congress, for the North Carolina General Assembly. Those tend to get the most, you know, clicks early on. But we had three separate other topics, and this latest one that got released this morning is something that I've been concerned about and wanted to gauge what North Carolinians were thinking about. You know, the issue of political violence is very much evident in our civil society. And I think as we move into a midterm election that's going to be highly contentious in this state and in other states, getting a sense of where North Carolinians are in terms of notions about could they expect political violence before the election? Do they think that the election is going to be held on November 3rd? Those were some public opinion ideas and concepts that we wanted to dig into.
And we're going to begin there, although the other three polls have been written about in The Observer and other places, and we'll talk about that. But let's talk about the poll that has just now been released, because this is actually breaking news as we come on the air. Your poll shows that North Carolinians expressed broad concern about political violence, but they maintain confidence that elections will take place as scheduled. There are some pundits who are putting that in the if category. What was the question that you asked that provoked that response?
So the question that we asked was, how likely do you think it is that political violence, and we defined it such as threats or physical attacks related to politics or campaigns, will occur before November's general election? And what we found was 6 out of 10 North Carolinians said it's likely some kind of political violence may occur. Less than 2 out of 10 said not likely. So we're seeing a fairly broad consensus, and it actually stretches across the political spectrum. Democrats, Republicans, and independents, all of them were above 60% saying there's a potential for political violence coming before November 3rd.
And there's also, this poll also indicates that respondents expressed significant concern about the state of our democracy. Did they have an opportunity to explain what specifically they were concerned about?
Well, we asked then a series of questions of the 1,000 North Carolinians weighted Who might be the potential targets of these political violences? We gave them several different categories, several different groups, and the number one ranked one, almost 7 out of 10 North Carolinians thought that political events, rallies, campaign stops could be the potential target of political violence. Right behind that was government buildings. And then we asked and gave the options of Republican candidates, Republican voters, election officials, those who run our elections, Democratic candidates, and Democratic voters. And at least 4 out of 10 North Carolinians said all of those groups are likely potential targets of political violence, but it was really the public-facing campaign activities that garnered the most concern about potential violence.
And we're going to get into all, we'll dig into all of that, but did I hear you correctly when you said who was most concerned about this? Is it equal? Are Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and liberals equally concerned about this?
This is one of the surprising things that, yes, across the political spectrum, Democrats, independents, and Republicans, all of them at least 60% or greater, said that there is a potential likelihood for political violence before November's general election.
Andrew.
And I think that reflects what I see kind of out in the field. There is definitely an undercurrent of concern. I wouldn't say an undercurrent of fear, because I don't think that's quite the right word, but it's become baked into political activity today in a way that it wasn't maybe 10 to 15 years ago, where if you're doing a campaign event, if you're doing a rally, security has to be on your list of on your checklist of things to deal with and be concerned about. You know, I've been invited to political events that have ultimately been canceled because that there was some threat that was deemed credible. So it's just part of the day-to-day campaign life these days.
Do you separate the potential for political violence, Michael, from people's concerns about the state of our democracy, which many see as being under attack?
We didn't ask that kind of specific question, so I don't have the kind of crosstab analysis that I think you're looking for. But we have asked in the past a question on surveys about the strength of American democracy. And what we are finding is a huge split between how Democrats, particularly here in North Carolina, and how North Carolina Republicans see the strength of American democracy. I mean, we're in the 250th year of this nation, and we have asked questions in the past and will do so again in August about where on a spectrum, 0, this democracy has failed completely, to 10, it is as strong as it's ever been. Not surprisingly, based on who is in control of the federal government, particularly the White House, Republicans tend to see American democracy much more healthy than Democrats do. Independents are kind of reflective of that middle ground, what I call bridge between the two partisan camps in this state. So I don't have the details and analysis for applying this political violence question. I think the thing, again, to kind of hit on is the notability of across the political spectrum, people are concerned about political violence going into the fall campaign.
And Paige, I'm taking political violence out of it. It seems if you watch these cable news shows where they have pundits from both sides of the aisle around the table with the hosts, it is the Democratic pundits, the liberal pundits, who seem more concerned about the future of our democracy. From what you know of what your readers tell you, and I know you get all kinds of response to opinion articles in The Observer that you write and others write, are the concerns coming mostly from Democrats, or are Republicans equally concerned about the future of democracy, not violence?
I think I would, if you presented it to people like kind of in an abstract way, as this poll does, you did see people like saying in general, having a candidate that violates a democratic norm, that is something that's concerning to them. But I think you also saw in the poll that sometimes people who are like see themselves as belonging to one side or the other are willing to overlook those things. And I think that's sort of probably related to why it seems like one side versus the other is more concerned, I think, just because of which party is in the White House and in Congress. That kind of influences who is going to be more concerned about it. I think if the if it was reversed, I think you would probably see Republicans raising concerns if it was the Democratic president doing it. So I think that's just sort of how it goes with how partisan everything is these days.
Andrew.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with the nature of how campaigns are won these days. You know, we like to think of elections as each candidate presenting their message and trying to persuade voters, but that's not really how elections are won today. It's all a turnout game. And so your main opponent is not necessarily the opposing political opponent. Your opponent is apathy. So that gives candidates an incentive to make every election existential. And so what we're seeing there is if you're making the campaign existential, a great message is, you know, you better vote now or else democracy is going to end. And it's all about driving turnout.
But in fairness, those on the left who seem to be most concerned about the state of our democracy will point directly to Donald Trump and what he's been saying and what he's been doing, and at Republicans at both the federal and state levels and their machinations on, in terms of changing how our elections are conducted, who gets to vote, when votes are counted, whether you can vote by mail, etc., allegations of voter fraud, which have not been founded, but they're still being stirred up at every turn. Are those fears by Democrats founded or unfounded, Andrew?
It's a fair question. I don't want to say founded or unfounded because I think, and you, if you wanted someone who's going to be a Trump defender, you picked the wrong Republican to be on the show. I'm not going to defend his demeanor and a lot of the things that he says. However, I do think it's worth pointing out that it's a sign of that our democracy, our republic is strong, that a figure with authoritarian tendencies is not able to make such dramatic changes, that we are not in danger of losing our country. We're not in danger of losing our republic. And I think that's a testament to the strength of the system that our founders set up.
But we seem to be on a razor's edge here when it comes to a lot of these things. Dr. Bitzer, there has been this steady rise in political violence. It's kind of reminiscent of the 1960s when, with the assassination of John F. Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King and others. And as I said, as we said, your survey indicates nearly two-thirds of the people questioned believe political violence is likely before the November election. As an historian, put that into context. When have we ever been in this kind of a period before where people may have felt the same way?
I would point to the 1850s leading into the 1860s and the political violence of an American Civil War. That to me, and I think to most historians, would be the penultimate, I mean, the capstone of the kind of political violence that we talk about. You're referencing the 1960s and particularly 1968. Two major assassinations, a political party that was tearing itself apart at its own convention, riots in the streets. I mean, those kinds of events have been part of our history, and we need to acknowledge that. But we are in a different time now.
We're going to talk about four different polls that Catawba College and YouGov conducted. We're talking about the fourth that was just released moments ago about the state of our democracy and the potential for political violence with Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, Paige Mastin from The Observer, and Andrew Dunn from Longleaf Politics. We're coming right back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte, celebrating 95 years of impact in the Carolinas, strengthening nonprofits, neighborhoods, and people through the support of charitable contributions. More at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a series of polls conducted in June, and I guess in June, right, Michael? Mostly in June.
Early June, June 1st through the 10th.
Okay. A series of polls conducted by Catawba College and YouGov, and Michael Bitzer runs all of that. He's a professor of history and politics at Catawba College. Paige Mastin is also with us. She is the deputy opinion editor of the Charlotte Observer, and Andrew Dunn, whose writing appears in the Observer occasionally, is also a conservative political columnist and founder of Longleaf Politics. So, Michael, the survey that was just released this morning on the state of our democracy and political violence indicates that most respondents, if I read this correctly, most respondents believe Republican candidates are the second likeliest targets of violence, just behind buildings, government buildings, which is strange to me, followed by Republican voters and elections officials, and then come Democratic candidates and Democratic voters. And both did both Republicans and Democrats rank it in that way?
No. And this is where our partisan identification really, I think, starts to influence some of the dynamics at play. When you look at Republican candidates who are number three, political events were number one, government buildings number two, then Republican candidates, 52% overall said that they were likely targets. But when you divide it up between Democrats and Republicans, Republicans were at 63% saying our own candidates are likely to be political targets, only 43% of Democrats, a 20-point partisan gap. You see that also with the Democratic candidates. 58% of Democrats said, yeah, our guys and gals, our candidates are going to be likely political targets. Among Republicans, it was only 36% saying the opposition would be likely targets. So this is where our political identification really comes into play, based on whose tribe is getting kind of asked about in terms of these dynamics.
And yet we have seen candidates and office holders on both sides of the aisle be victims of this. I suppose the most visible one is Donald Trump. He's experienced at least three attempts on his life, one on television, live. Judges have been similarly targeted successfully, in one case, I think, in the Northeast. We know other politicians of both sides of the aisle have been doxxed. They've had SWAT teams descending on their homes because of people calling in hoaxes. Andrew, what's driving all of this?
What's driving the violence?
And the potential for violence. I mean, because I guess you could call doxing somebody political violence in a way, because it does put them and their families at risk. But what's driving it? Why are people doing this?
I think a lot of it's pure terrorism. I think that there is there's a copycat factor, and then there's the recognition that if you commit or threaten to commit violence, or if you do some of these things, that you will get attention. And so I don't see it as a ideological.
But they do it many times, Andrew. Many times they do it anonymously. We don't know who does these things. It just happens.
I think you're right to an extent, but also, I mean, people are increasingly living in online communities where you can get fame or notoriety in your online community that's not necessarily attached to your name. So I think that that dynamic still comes into play, even if it's quote unquote anonymous.
Paige, same question to you. What's driving this? And have you noticed, and maybe you don't get these kind of letters to the editor at The Observer, maybe that's strictly on social media, but have you noticed that kind of rhetoric coming into the newspaper?
I think I notice like maybe just like vitriolic rhetoric, like name calling, like just kind of like hateful types of messages. Obviously, like words and actions are really quite different. And I think as kind of to Andrew's point, the kind of use of language against people that you disagree with is very common. But I think that actually escalating that to real violence, I think is something that's very different. And I think that that kind of has a lot more to do with other factors, like kind of the communities that you're a part of online, sort of like psychological factors, all of that. But I do notice kind of just like the division and the tension very often.
I don't know how long you've been with the opinion section of the newspaper, so maybe you don't have enough history to answer this question accurately, but have you seen the uptick? Can you trace the uptick? How long has it been going on that the vitriol that you're getting about politics and politicians has increased?
I'm sort of pretty young, so I think as long as I've been writing, it has been something that I've had to deal with. Even in college, when I wrote for my college newspaper, I started writing in 2019. So even in college, like comments and emails were something I had to deal with frequently. And so just not from my personal experience, but I would say that it probably, you can kind of start to see it tick up like in the past decade.
So, Michael, we've said that voters, the people you talk to, I'm assuming most of them are voters, say that both Democrats and Republicans are targets, and they fear for the candidates, they fear for elections officials, they fear for voters' safety going to the polls this fall. But they have not lost confidence in the electoral process itself, which sounds optimistic, but strange to me. We hear politicians on the right constantly fretting about election integrity. Does this mean that those warnings, those threats, those misgivings are falling on deaf ears? People don't believe it.
Well, I think we have to first, recognize the question that we asked was about whether the general election would be held as scheduled on November 3rd. And over 7 out of 10 North Carolinians said, yes, we are going to have the general election. It will be on November 3rd. And again, that was across the board, 70% of Democrats, 70% of independents, 81% of Republicans said that the election will be held as scheduled. So that, to me, gives some confidence about election integrity. We're actually going to do another poll in August about this issue, about election integrity and confidence among North Carolinians. 2 years ago, we did it right before the 2024 election. We found 7 out of 10 North Carolinians had confidence. I'm hoping that we'll find a similar number, if not potentially slightly higher. Interestingly enough, after the election, we did the exact same questions. 80% of North Carolinians after the 2024 election had confidence in North Carolina's elections. So I'm hoping that we'll find similar dynamics at play.
Andrew, and I think that finding, sorry to cut you off, I think that finding is reflective of what reality is. I think, the premise that you're coming from, that everyone is at each other's throats and that we're on a razor's edge, I don't find accurate at all. I mean, I think if you live online in, the far left or the far right on Blue Sky or 4chan or what have you, yeah, you'll see people who are working themselves into a frenzy about all this. But I don't think normal North Carolinians are living that way. I mean, when I take my kids to the pool, nobody's at each other's throats. I live in a very area with a lot of different political persuasions. We all get along. I think by and large, there is an undercurrent of concern, like I said earlier, but it's not an overwhelming fear. And people don't feel like we're on the edge of catastrophe. And I don't think that we are.
Okay. The people talking about or casting aspersions on election integrity are not the people who lost the elections. They're the people who won the last elections. Republicans are in control of everything in Washington. They're in control of our General Assembly here in North Carolina. And yet it is Republicans who are saying our elections are rigged, are unsafe, that they're rife with fraud, and we're going to root it out. Democrats, who have lost everywhere until recently, aren't saying anything about that. How do you explain that, Andrew?
I must not be listening to the same news stations that you're listening to, because I don't hear that at all. know that there's an election there are bill moves, going
wait a minute.
There
have been moves. There have been moves at the state level here in Texas, in other Republican-controlled states, to control how elections are conducted and operated, who can vote, restricting voting locations, voting times. In Georgia, you can't carry a bottle of water with you to the polls, all to discourage people who have to stand in line for long amounts of time. And all of that is coming from the right side of the aisle, and all of that is coming because as they do that, they're saying our elections are rife with fraud, and we're going to root it out. What do you mean you don't hear you don't witness this? You don't hear it?
Well, I do hear some of the more extreme voices calling things like that extreme voter suppression. But when you look at the data, and perhaps Dr. Bitzer could back me up on this, we don't see any drop off in voter participation. Our voter turnout has been higher than similar elections in previous years. There's a lot of fear-mongering about that, but I don't think it's reality.
Most respondents to the Catawba College YouGov poll also said that they would reject candidates who violate democratic norms, while a committed minority of partisans were willing to overlook those behaviors. So let's break that down, Michael. How many would reject candidates who violate democratic norms? And what are those norms?
So we asked a series of hypothetical scenarios, one of them being candidates, would you be more or less likely to support a candidate who encouraged campaign workers to tell registered voters they must re-register to vote even though it's not true? And that garnered the lowest level among Democrats and Republican identifiers. Among Democrats more likely to vote for, only 19% said they would vote for that kind of a candidate. 55% of Democrats said, nope, I would be less likely to vote for them. Among Republicans, it was 16% saying they would vote for that kind of a candidate. 50% said that they would not. Then we asked a series of other scenarios leading up to the issue of partisan gerrymandering. We asked the question, if a candidate supported partisan gerrymandering the state's congressional map to eliminate the opposition from being elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, there we found among Democrats and Republicans the highest percentage of folks saying, yeah, I would be more likely to vote for that kind of candidate. And it was actually among more Democrats than Republicans, but it was still fairly close. 31% of Democrats said they would vote for that kind of a candidate. 27% of Republicans said they would support that candidate.
Let's be clear about that. Both Republicans and Democrats in your poll said they would support candidates who support gerrymanders that help their side, essentially, is what they're saying, correct?
Correct. Correct. And most notably, it is the self-identified partisans, not the independents who lean to one party or the other, but it is the true believers that have the highest level of support for somebody to say, let's wipe out the opposition through gerrymandering. Yeah, I'm good with that kind of a candidate.
Does that surprise you, Paige?
Not really. I think that in general, you kind of see people more willing to accept something when it's good for their side and bad for the other. I mean, I know, obviously, many years ago, Democrats also gerrymandered the legislative maps in North Carolina. And then that was something Republicans were really upset about. I believe even Tim Moore and Phil Berger supported legislation that would have ended gerrymandering and would have made redistricting an independent process. And then that was when they were in the minority. And now you see that when they're in the opposite position, it's something that they like to do as well. So I think you kind of see this undercurrent of people willing to support something when it favors them politically and kind of saying, no, I'm not going to do that, or no, that's wrong, when it results in a good outcome for them is more rare.
Andrew, as Paige pointed out, both sides do this. And when Democrats were in control of the legislature, they did it to Republicans here. Although Republicans do it better because they have better tools now, thanks to computerized technology and the availability to laser target voters, et cetera. But could some of this be driven, being driven by what we're witnessing around the country, by Republican and Democratic efforts to essentially draw their own lines so that they win these elections? And so people are saying, for the most part, we don't like that, unless they're true partisans who do like that. What should the results of this survey tell politicians about this practice?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that we are right now in a partisan arms race on who can gerrymander the most seats. But I don't feel like that's very historically unusual. That's kind of how things have been done in American politics since almost the very beginning. I think what's worth keeping in mind is that gerrymandering and redistricting, it gets partisans very riled up, but it's not an issue that breaks through to the everyday voter. You're never going to see it as one of the top issues in a campaign because people don't care enough to follow it that closely. So I think it's a great issue to kind of raise money and to rally the base. But in terms of persuading people and getting people interested in it, it's just not there. And I think right now, because we've had red states do it and blue states do it, It's just completely off the table in terms of a wedge issue.
So we've been talking about some of the things you discovered in the fourth poll that was released just this morning, Michael. Let's move on to the first poll, which was released in June, taking the state's political temperature. It shows that Democrats hold the advantage on both the congressional and legislative ballot tests, while Trump is losing ground with Republican voters. He's underwater. 43% approve, 54% of North Carolinians disapprove. How much of that is due to the war in Iran, to which most North Carolinians say they are opposed? And how much is due to the economy and other factors like the failure to release the Epstein files?
I think there's a combination of different factors at play. I think certainly when you ask most voters what could be a potential top topic for them, it is typically economics. It's usually either unemployment or, in this case, I think inflation is really the issue at concern. Layer on top of that a war created over the past several months now that has been deepening, and we're seeing that play out, I think, in his approval and, more importantly, his disapproval numbers.
So we'll dig into that poll as well as the poll on American identity, which was also conducted in June. And as time allows, we'll get into affordability. I think we need to move that up in the ranking because that's on everybody's mind, as you just pointed out. Dr. Michael Bitzer is here from Catawba College, along with Andrew Dunn, conservative columnist for Longleaf Politics, and Paige Mastin, the deputy opinion editor for the Charlotte Observer. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a series of polls released in June and just now this morning from Catawba College and YouGov concerning the state of our democracy and various aspects of it. Dr. Michael Bitzer is responsible for that. Paige Mastin is here, deputy opinion editor for the Charlotte Observer. And Andrew Dunn, a conservative political columnist whose writing appears in The Observer, but he's also the founder of Longleaf Politics. That's the Substack publication. Just a second ago, Andrew, we were talking with Michael Bitzer about the mood here in this latest poll dealing with Donald Trump's approval ratings and the fact that the Republicans are on, Democrats rather, are on track to maybe take control of the state house, amazingly enough, and our congressional delegations, the House and Senate. We know that it is normal for the party that holds the White House to lose ground in Congress in the midterm elections. If it is true that Democrats hold an advantage both congressionally and legislative here at Lee in North Carolina, is that why?
It could be. And go back to your point about Donald Trump's approval ratings in North Carolina. They have fallen, but that's also very normal for a political figure as their term progresses. If you look at where Donald Trump's approval stands in North Carolina today versus the same period in 2018, it's almost exactly the same. So Trump did win North Carolina three times, but he's never been overwhelmingly popular in the state. I think he wins because he's very successful at making his elections a binary choice. You're either for me or you're against me. But that doesn't translate down the ballot. President Trump is very good at getting himself elected. I don't think he has much interest or skill at getting other Republicans elected. And I think that is what we're set up to see in the 2026 elections in North Carolina. I know there has been a good bit of talk about Democrats actually taking the state house. I've looked at the numbers. It is theoretically possible, but it's also highly unlikely, mostly because we're in a very different environment now than 2018. In 2018, when Democrats picked up, I believe it was 9 seats in the state house, you still had the suburban metro areas around Charlotte, around Raleigh, were still held by Republicans. Today, those are all held by Democrats. So there's less fertile ground for Democrats to actually pick up seats and flip a chamber.
Paige, from what you're hearing as both somebody, a journalist and an opinion writer, and what you see coming into the Observer unsolicited from readers, do you think that a blue wave is even in the offing? Is it even possible when it comes to the legislature?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on how you define blue wave. I think that certainly we will most likely see Democrats doing better than they have in the past couple of cycles, because those cycles have been more favorable for Republicans. I think there are a few seats that are toss-up seats where you could see Democrats win those seats and maybe a couple of seats that maybe tilt a little bit more Republican. Those races could end up being closer than you think. But kind of as Andrew said, it's very difficult to actually have a wave that's large enough to shift power. And kind of we've been discussing gerrymandering. That's kind of the point of gerrymandering, is to insulate your maps against those kinds of shifts in public opinion. So it kind of winds up requiring like a historical level of a blue wave in order to make that kind of difference. But I do think that you will see Democrats do well. I don't necessarily think it'll be good enough to totally shift the balance of power. But I think a supermajority for Republicans is probably not in the cards.
Nationally, Democrats are hoping against hope that they will take both the House and the Senate, and their Senate chances seem to change hour by hour, even minute by minute, with what's going on in Maine and other places. But here in North Carolina, Roy Cooper seems to hold the edge. The Catawba College YouGov poll joined others in, I think, predicting that Roy Cooper's advantage is clear against Michael Whatley, the former head of the GOP National Committee. And you say that the Roy Cooper's advantage is not simply a function of Democratic support. Independents are playing a role. Is that due to the name recognition Cooper has over Michael Whatley, Michael? Or is it due to the fact that he was, Roy Cooper, a relatively popular governor who has never lost an election for anything he's run for? Or because Whatley is either weak or the wrong GOP candidate for the time? Or is this indicative of the changing tide of opinions about Republicans? I'm throwing it all at you.
You're putting it all out there for a buffet here. I think certainly you have to factor in Cooper's historic of victories in terms of statewide elections. He was able to buck the federal trend of voting slightly more Republican. He would take the state executive, the chief state executive officer, governor, and have it vote Democratic. So this could be the potential test of, can he translate that from a state level executive office to a federal office? That's where Democrats have really not been successful in doing. The last time was in 2008 with Kay Hagan. That was a unique year in North Carolina political history. I think in terms of the numbers, as you mentioned, independents are really a driving force in North Carolina politics. And in this particular poll, 50% of them are supporting Roy Cooper at this moment, with only 23% supporting Michael Whatley. Will that shift? Will Whatley be able to pull his base and potential independents who lean to the Republican Party to his advantage and tighten that margin? We'll see in later surveys this fall.
I don't want to run out of time before we talk about the other two surveys, but I do want to ask Andrew this question. You've written that Donald Trump has made Michael Whatley, he made Michael Whatley, and now he is dooming him. So what is your take on this race?
Yeah, my take is I like Michael Whatley a lot. I got to know him personally back when he was the state GOP chairman. I think he has a good heart for public service, good family man, et cetera. But I think barring some major black swan event, I think Roy Cooper is going to win this race. And a lot of it has to do with Whatley not having great name recognition, not having his own political brand. He's almost a pure cipher for President Donald Trump. He is Trump's pick, and that was plenty enough to help him win to win the primary. But in a general election, you got to have more substance there. And Whatley is quickly running out of time and money to layer on that sort of substance.
And very quickly, Paige, you have written that Whatley's problem is one of authenticity and the fact that he's running out of time, as Andrew just said, to defend himself or define himself against a candidate that everybody pretty much knows and pretty much has a positive opinion of, whether you're a Democrat or Republican. Expand on that.
Yeah, I think sort of the authenticity issue is an issue because, as Andrew said, he's not very well known. I think that when people don't know you, one, it opens up the opportunity for the first time that they hear about you or learn about you to be in a way that you wouldn't maybe choose to introduce yourself to those voters. But also, I think just when people don't know you, they're less likely to give you the benefit of the doubt. I think that Roy Cooper, people at this point, people's opinions of him are pretty solidified, and they are, for the most part, pretty favorable. And I think people, they know who he is, whether they like him or not, like, that's different. But I don't think that they have doubts really about who he is. I think he's shown them that. And I think with Whatley, that's sort of his problem, is that he kind of doesn't have that same amount of trust or goodwill or even familiarity with voters to sort of help him over some of these humps that he's facing. And so I think that's kind of why they end up being maybe bigger than they might be for another campaign.
Michael, your third YouGov Catawba College poll dealt with affordability. Bill Clinton's campaign manager or strategist, James Carville, coined the phrase, "It's the economy, stupid," to remind people what voters most cared about. And when asked about his concerns over rising costs, Trump has said, "Not even a little bit. I don't think about Americans' financial situations." And he's characterized affordability as a Democrat hoax. Would his eyes be opened by the results of your poll?
I would think so, but one never knows. We asked the question, how difficult, if at all, is it for you to afford your regular monthly expenses? And 57% of respondents said it was difficult to afford our basic monthly expenses. When we asked, are you cutting back on regular purchases over the past month? 72% of North Carolinians said yes. And that was across the partisan board yet again. So this issue of affordability, this issue ultimately of its economics, is certainly a major factor in the minds of North Carolinians. And will that be one of the drivers of a voter's calculus as to who they vote for? We know in the past that has been the case.
That was going to be my next question. And of course, this is not unique to North Carolina. This is happening across the country. So history is prologue, or past is prologue, this might have an impact. We're watching a lot of Democratic socialists, however, win races in Democratic primaries in other parts of the country because of this exact thing, affordability, and people want to change. They want a better shot at getting their piece of the pie. Have we, Paige, do you think, reached a breaking point? Are the chickens coming home to roost on the approach, the economic approach that politicians both on the left and right have been taking in recent years? And will politicians have to do something to relieve the stress that people are feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you ask people, like, what issue affects them most in their everyday lives, it's going to be something economic related. And when while they may have strong feelings about other issues that I think sometimes Democrats have centered around, I think ultimately the most powerful one is going to be affordability. And you saw that even in 2020, where a big reason why Trump and Republicans had so much success is because they kind of honed in on that issue, and Biden was the one in the position of having to defend the economy and trying to tell voters that it wasn't actually as bad as they felt like it was. And so
I'm just kidding. One of the reasons that Donald Trump was successful in becoming president the first time was because he was very adroit in reading the political tea leaves and translating that into rhetoric that people could connect to. And that's why they voted him in. It's partly why they voted him in the second time. And yet he just made this tone-deaf remark that I quoted, Andrew. I don't care about, not even a little bit, about Americans' financial situation. And this is kind of a Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake comment. And that, along with administration policies that seem to have worked against ordinary Americans and made life unaffordable, more difficult, is that something that is generally recognized among Republicans? And do they have a solution for it? Even Democrats, even these social Democrats have been talking about, yeah, we have this problem, but I don't hear any solutions coming from them either.
Yeah, and to be fair, I do think that was a tone-deaf remark from President Trump. But what he said was that he doesn't consider Americans' financial situations in his negotiations with Iran, which is a very different thing, still a dumb thing to say. And your broader point is still legitimate. I think President Trump and Republicans were elected in 2024 on the affordability issue. They campaigned on bringing prices down, on bringing wages up. But then once they got into office, national Republicans have really taken zero steps to address the affordability issue. And that's really going to come back to bite them. But I do think you're seeing some really strong moves from North Carolina Republicans at the state level, especially around property taxes, that will help their message in November.
Just before the 4th of July, you released a poll, Michael, in which you asked questions about the principles set out in the Declaration of Independence and how people feel we live up to those ideals. And I've heard instances of people being read passages from the Declaration and they say it's treasonous against the United States. They don't realize that it's these comments in the Declaration are being directed at King George. Please tell me that that is not what your survey discovered.
It's not. And we asked the question, how important do you feel that the Declaration of Independence means for the United States today? Make that document from 250 years relevant in today's terms. And what we found was that 84% of North Carolinians basically said, this is of high importance. And again, that was across the partisan board. 8 out of 10 Democrats, 88% of Republicans, 85% of independents said the ideals, the concepts, the principles in the Declaration of Independence from 250 years ago are critical and of high importance in today's dynamics. Now, there are differences about how each partisan group sees the importance and the ultimate relevancy, but that was striking to me that we're at that high of a level about the basic principles.
That's striking, and it gives one reason for hope, but then there's that 20% who doesn't think that the Declaration has any relevance to today. How troubled should we be by that?
Well, let me clarify. Moderate importance, you know, kind of important, that was about 11%. Folks who said it was low importance was only 6%. So I think in terms of the dynamics of what we're seeing in this very partisan, divided, polarized age, let's take 80% plus and run with it if we can.
I only have 30 seconds left, and I wanted to talk about some of the phrases that you asked about within the document. And if I got this right, only 7% selected the phrase "government derives its power from the consent of the governed" as being important. That's kind of scary.
That is correct, and yes.
Yes, it's scary. We'll leave it there. Dr. Michael Bitzer, Director of the Center for North Carolina Politics and Public Service at Catawba College, Paige Mastin, Deputy Opinion Editor of the Charlotte Observer, Andrew Dunn, Conservative Columnist for Longleaf Politics. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Our intern is Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.